back to the Select Committee on Judicial Reform and Redistricting. I know there's no place you'd rather be on a Friday afternoon when the sun finally came back out, Friday morning. But we'll try to be judicious with our time and get Senator McKissick on the golf course by this afternoon. So I first want to recognize our sergeants-at-arms. We have members from both bodies, so I want to thank Bill Bass, David Layton, Jim Moran, Billy Fritcher, and Steve McKeag for being with us today. Thank you, gentlemen, for serving the committee. And just as an initial housekeeping announcement, I want to just make the members aware that there won't be any votes that we'll be taking today, so you don't have to be concerned about that. And any other remarks from my co-chairs before we begin?
No, Mr. Chairman.
The members, hopefully you have all the handouts. There should be three maps, well, the multiple maps, but three versions, A, B, and C, which are the ones that have been discussed to date, and, of course, the different overlays of those. And then there should be a copy of the two bills that are on the agenda, which are House bills that pass the House that also should accompany a bill summary. So I guess we'll move into the second item on the agenda, if Representative Burr is prepared to take the podium. And we'll have a presentation and discussion of the most recent judicial redistricting proposals and incumbency data. And Representative Burr, you're recognized to begin that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. At this point, I want to, as a chair pointed out, we're in the process of passing out options A, which we've already had a presentation on at a previous meeting, but passing that out again along with options B and C. And the reason all of those being passed out today is because we have the incumbency data and have that has been incorporated into all three versions of the or all three options that the committee has had before it up to this point. So the incumbency data was put online on the committee website several months ago, so you should have had that to review before the meeting for the options that are out there. Now, this data is based off of, as I think we discussed before, that we were receiving information from AOC, and the incumbency report would be based off of the addresses, the information that we received from the Administrative Office of the Court, and central staff took that information of the addresses and incorporated it in to these maps. So it is possible that there may be an error or two with a particular judge or their address, someone's moved, something's changed since this information was put together or was provided to AOC and what they provided to us. So if members, if you see something that's that doesn't look correct in terms of where it shows a judge, which particular district, where the judges live at, reside at, let me know, let Eric Churchill and central staff know so we can make sure we get that corrected as we move forward. So we want to have that information. So you've got the large maps with the dots on it show you where the judges live. Now, they're, what you may notice is there may be a district where there are going to be some where you're going to see just one dot, but there are multiple members for that or multiple seats for that particular area. And that could be because of two there are two factors that could be causing there to only be one dot there. One is it's new seats that are being added, so there's only perhaps one incumbent judge that resides there. The other is if there are multiple judges in this same precinct, it's just going to show one dot on there. So it's something you have to, you can look at the dots, but then you need to flip over and pull out the break down the incumbency report, where you will see all of the information broken down by each judicial district with the total number of judges that each of the proposed district has. You'll see the list of the judges' names, the year that they were elected, the year their terms expire, and then their mandatory retirement date. So hopefully from that you can look through and see exactly where you may find a handful of folks that are double bunked. You may find that there are not as many as have been reported out there, which would be the case. And just to run through the particulars on options B and C as compared to option A, and walk you through some of the changes there. Option B and C were based off of some of the feedback that we received at previous meetings, some of the recommendations and concerns, I guess, from different committee members and the public in terms of the districts. For example, if you look at Mecklenburg County, you will see that Mecklenburg County, with respect to the Superior Court districts, that as option A, where it has a two multi-member districts in the county. We heard from some of you that you wanted to see a map, you wanted to look at smaller districts, single-member districts. Obviously, what that's going to end up doing is potentially double-bunking more judges that happen to live in the same areas, but you have an option B and C, single-member Superior Court districts there in Mecklenburg County. You've got the same for Cumberland. You see the same for Forsyth County, and then you have a change with respect to Wake County as well. With the districts there, you'll notice if you're looking at your option A versus your option B or C, you'll see that there is essentially there are single-member Superior Court districts except for one, which is 10D, and it has two Superior Court judge seats in that district. And that proposal was worked on by the judges here in Wake County, and from everything I understand, there seems to be pretty close to unanimous agreement on those particular maps. If I'm wrong about that, please speak up and let us know. But my understanding are the judges here in Wake County are in favor of those maps that are in option B and C. And the difference between the biggest difference between B and C, those maps would be Durham County, where based on the feedback we've received from some of the judges there and having the incumbency data, we developed a option C, the map that's there, to try to eliminate one of the double bunkings of a district court judge. So that would reduce that number. So that is the latest version, along with the changes to those election sub-districts. Both of those maps, the bills, tied to those two particular maps, invest a significant amount of additional resources in the judicial district. If you look at your old workload formulas from option A or any previous workload formula, you will see when you compare it to options B and C that these latest drafts work to bring our Superior Court, District Court, and the prosecutorial, the ADAs, to bring them up pretty close to 100% in terms of what it shows their need is, what AOC's workload analysis shows the need is for each of these judicial districts. And these maps, again, continue to update the outdated districts, but make the investments that we need to make within each of the respective judicial districts to try to provide them with the resources they need to do their job, to do their jobs. So you can go through and see where that is in fact the case, and we make a pretty significant investment with the ADAs, Superior Court judges, and District Court judges. But happy to take any questions if there are any, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Burr. And I see Representative John has a question, sir.
Representative Burr, you indicated that the Wake judges were fully and supportive of the, I believe, version C, is that correct?
B and C are identical, yes, sir.
Right. Would it not be more accurate to say, Representative Burr, that the judges favor leaving things as they are, but if they are to change, their preferences to go towards B or C?
Representative John, having worked with him through some of the Wake County delegation, this is what they brought forward and said is a proposal that they support and can be happy with, and that's as far as our conversations have gone.
Follow up or not?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other members have a question? Senator McKissick.
Representative Burr, do you have any type of a document that summarizes the distinctions between these various plans? Because I'm sure you're thoroughly acquainted with the nuances for those of us who may not be familiar with the distinctions between them. It would certainly be helpful to have kind of a chart or a graph or some document that kind of summarizes the most significant distinctions between them.
Senator McKissick, I don't have anything to share with you today other than you've got the maps, you've got the specific plans, each plan to compare side by side. But happy to sit down with you if you'd like and go through those and talk through the differences between the different versions of the different editions of House Bill 717 and then the multiple options that we have presented here in this joint select committee.
Follow up. And of course, I guess I welcome the opportunity to sit down with you to do that, and perhaps we could have staff prepare something that would summarize it that I think would help others other than just us to sit down and understand that. So I would make that request of staff.
Certainly, I'll work with them to see if we can get something produced for you, Senator McKissick.
Let me just clarify. So, Senator McKissick, you're looking for something a list that would show what districts maybe didn't change and then what districts did change. And so I've discussed with staff, and they're going to try to see if they can figure out at least how to put something together that would alert you as to which districts had had a change to those.
And Senator McKissick, I assume you want not only districts that perhaps had a sub-district that changed with respect to the elections, but their number of resources as well. Is that what you want that as well?
That would be correct, Representative Burr. I mean, that would be very helpful, and I know you know all these nuances and details, but it's challenging if you're just getting them out in your hands this morning to be able to study them quickly and do that kind of a analysis. So if we could work to get that, and it sounds like Erica can pull that together, that would be great. A couple of other quick questions, if I could
follow up.
Recognize for a series of questions, that might be helpful.
You recognize.
Representative Burr, when you were working on these districts, did you ever use compactness as a criteria in terms of looking at the way they might be structured or designed? And if so, what kind of compactness variables that you identified try to help determine how these maps might be drawn?
Senator, my focus was on correcting the imbalance in the election sub-districts that currently exist across the state in many of the Superior Court sub-districts in many of our urban counties. So my focus was on making sure that the populations were balanced out in those counties to bring us more in line with the Blankenship case, and certainly work to work within the boundaries of the precincts that are in place to do that. We don't decide here at the legislature what precincts look like. Those are done county by county. So working within, trying not to split precincts, keep them the same, and since certainly the requests have come in from judges, judicial districts, House members and Senate members about different particular items they want to change, the precincts they want to move around, to make sure we were addressing any needs of judges to reduce double bunking, have taken that into account and worked on that up to this point. So have tried to focus on getting the population correct and balanced out in each district and provide each of the judicial districts with the resources they need based on the workload analysis.
And when you say you use population data, did you use the data from the 2010 census, or did you use any data that might have been more updated that might be available through the state that would be more accurate and current, since we're 8 years out from when that population analysis was done, and certainly there are going to be major counties in the state that have gained population, other areas that have lost population? What?
Senator McKissick, the 2010 census is the most recent census, and it is certainly more up-to-date than the censuses that were used for the maps that are in place from the 1980s and 1990s.
And when you were looking at these districts, did you give any consideration to the maximum number of counties that might be put into a district?
Senator McKissick, certainly when you get out into the far east and far western regions of the state and you have a very small population or number of counties, that results in larger judicial districts. And I think what have worked to do is we certainly know that there are currently large judicial districts and still a number of them in these proposed maps is to make sure that we're providing them with the resources that they need, and that's what I heard from a number of the judges in these particular areas, is that, you know, they can handle having to travel so long as they have the resources and they have the appropriate number of judges they need to manage district court within their county. So I think you'll see if you compare the number of judges to the workload analysis based on the districts that we've done just that, provided them with the resources they need. But certainly understand and sympathetic to folks having to travel long distances, but trying to make sure that we're getting the maximum use and value out of the taxpayers' dollars by not having terribly small, inefficient judicial districts, but at least get them up to where there is some decent population within a district.
And that brings me to two other questions. In terms of drive time, did you ever establish a parameter for the maximum drive time from one end of a district to another end of a district? Because some of these districts, as you say, they're in rural areas. There's a lot of drive time involved. I mean, was there any variable or any criteria used to establish what you would not go beyond or what was reasonable?
No criteria that we used for that. Just based off of conversations with judges. Certainly, if you tried to put some sort of restrictions on that, I mean, you go get into the mountains, and even when counties look close together, Senator Heiss, I would imagine it can be quite a distance to travel from one county to the other. So unless you want to start going in and saying, well, we're going to really restrict that, and then you're essentially forced to take counties like Buncombe and combine them with other counties to where perhaps you have four or five counties in the same judicial district with Buncombe just because they're close together and it's more compact in that respect of drive time. That would about be the only thing you really could do, but I don't have a feeling a lot of folks would particularly like that very much.
And in terms of workload data, did you look at workload data per county as opposed to per judicial district? Because I've seen a lot of data that comes out by district but not by county necessarily. So did you actually look at county workload data that was available to you? And if so, how did you identify what counties to group together? Because I don't know what the logic was behind certain county groupings, why one county might be grouped with one, let's say you were in judicial district, I'm just going to randomly cite, use a number. Let's say you had District 5 and you had three counties in it. Why would you include those particular three as opposed to others that might be better suited to be linked with based upon workload data or other variables that might have been considered? I'm just trying to understand the criteria overall.
Senator McKissick, you can look at, and they have a breakdown of the workload data by county, by counties, and that is every time a new option comes out, AOC pulls that information and totals each county's workload analysis to develop each district. So as the districts change, obviously the workload analysis for each district changes. And if you review that data, I think you'll find that most counties and thus most judicial districts themselves are pretty close to fully staffed based on what the recommendations are in the workload analysis provided by AOC.
If I could interrupt just for a minute. So in addressing part of your question, Senator McKissick, the StatPaks online have division data for all A, B, and C maps.
And I guess that was what I was looking at. I've seen a lot of judicial district data as opposed to county data for the 100 counties. That's why I asked that question, to see what data was available to you that might not be quite so obvious to others.
Well, I am sure AOC could provide you with a breakdown county by county of their workload analysis data if you wanted it. It is available and can be reviewed, I am sure, by you if you want it.
Did you give any thought to perhaps not going forward with this full expansive revision of these judicial districts at this time, since we're only 2 years out from the 2020 census and we could probably get very good workload data updated and analyzed perhaps a little bit more accurately than what it's been done in the past based upon changes that have occurred? Any thought given to perhaps doing a more thorough evaluative process to get current workload data rather than things that have been updated incrementally by AOC as opposed to by an outside independent entity that could come in and do this and then getting, you know, really good census data when 2020 comes? I mean, is there some reason we couldn't take a more deliberative approach to getting this done?
Senator McKissick, I believe the workload data is current, and I believe we've had a couple presentations on that information in these committees as they have discussed that. So this is not old data. It is current data that is updated frequently. And Senator McKissick, in terms of can we wait, certainly it's up to the General Assembly to decide whether or not we want to wait. My personal opinion is that this can's been kicked down the road long enough. We have folks in many of these counties that are being disenfranchised because they have these very unbalanced districts in Mecklenburg County, Guilford County, Forsyth County, and plenty of other urban counties, and I don't think it would be appropriate to wait, but it's certainly up to this body to make that decision. And I think the investments that we propose in these various options are needed, and certainly I would advocate for moving forward with making these investments in these judicial districts sooner rather than later.
And just two more questions, if I could, Mr. Chair. And that you talk about population data. I gather there is population data currently available that would at least go through 2016, perhaps even 2017, that could be utilized. Was there a reason why you didn't use that data that's available through the state? And then secondly, when you went and created these districts, what kind of ideal population that you established as being the target that you would use for either district court or superior court judges in terms of an optimal size district, and what was the range of deviation from that? For example, you know, we have legislative districts. For the House, it might be 79,000, or for the Senate, 191,000. But, you know, you could have population shifts 5% plus or minus. Was any comparable type of analysis done in terms of establishing optimal population and then using that optimal population to say we will allow deviations of X number of percentage points plus or minus in crafting these districts?
Senator McKissick, there is no minimum or maximum in terms of what you can have within in terms of population for each of the districts. I have worked to reduce the number of smaller districts and try to get to a point to where we're the smallest district is right around 100,000 in population. 4 or 5 years ago, you would have had five or six of our judicial districts would have been very much under 100,000, and now we're getting close to having a pretty much a bare minimum, a threshold right at 100,000. And certainly when you have your two largest counties with around a million people in each of those counties, it's difficult to sit here and divide up North Carolina when you've got 20% of your population sitting in two counties that are single judicial districts themselves.
I guess the last question would be simply this. Probably be a compound question, but that's simply to say, did any thought occur to you in terms of creating single-member districts as opposed to multi-member districts? And if so, why did you choose going with multi-member versus single-member, or maybe you did it in some areas but not all areas? And then lastly, if you could just review changes for Durham County in terms of what's proposed.
Senator McKissick, as you go through the different editions of 717 and the three options that have been presented to this committee, you will see there are some single-member Superior Court districts, there are some multi-member districts. Those have varied based on feedback we've received from those judicial districts. As I said in my earlier remarks, Mecklenburg County in Option A was multi-member Superior Court district. And in the B and C proposal, based on some of the feedback we heard, folks want to look at single-member districts. That is there. What you'll see if you look at the breakdown of data, and one reason I believe that the multi-member districts work a little bit better is because you reduce the likelihood of double bunking particular judges in those districts, and it gives you a little bit of a larger pool of applicants to run for those particular seats. So, you know, I think it's solely the preference of the General Assembly to decide whether or not you want single-member, multi-member districts, and you have the different options here, and certainly welcome your feedback and the feedback of anyone else who has a particular opinion about their area and whether they want single-member or multi-member districts. But, you know, based on the complaints I believe we heard from a couple of folks in the committee who didn't like the larger districts. You've got the single-member districts here to look at, but if you go with those, you're going to double bunk Senator Ford, a number of the judges in your community. I think you can see that in these examples as you break it down, and that's why we had multi-member districts to sort of give you reduce that likelihood.
And
last question.
Yeah, last question. It will be this time. Do you have political data, what I call stat packs, with benchmark races that would show us how these districts might perform in terms of their partisan?
Senator McKissick, I believe they prepared that
they did
data
in the past.
For you.
They did
previously, and it should be on the committee website.
I know we had it for the older maps, and I want to thank you all for providing that because I did request it. But it would be great to get that for these updated maps as well. So I would simply make that as a supplemental request. But thank you.
We're checking with staff. My belief is that it's already there, but if not, then they'll post it.
Thank you.
So in the queue, I've got Representative Jackson, then Senator Heiss, and Senator Ford. So Representative Jackson, thank you for your patience with the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question, I think, is for staff. I think at the last meeting that I attended, maybe in January, I'd asked for fiscal notes for these three plans because we're adding judges, and I can't find them on the website, and I was just wondering if they had been done.
Staff, have an answer.
William Childs, fiscal. I'm sorry, I have not done a fiscal note for this. I wasn't aware there was a request for that. I do have a fiscal note out for some of the language in House Bill 717, and I can provide a fiscal note for this. I'm sorry, Representative Jackson, I didn't know that that was requested.
Do you know, William, about how long it would take to calculate that?
I could get that by probably early next week. I don't think it would take very long at all.
Okay, thank you. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The second thing I wanted to ask Representative Burr, if I could ask a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. How many questions would you like to pose?
It's probably three or four.
All right, you're recognized for three or four questions.
Representative Burr, specifically talking about Wake County, my recollection is that in your original proposal in 717, was that Wake County would get additional district court judge. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And in this plan, I believe, at least in versions B and C, Wake County is getting two additional district court judges. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Would you agree with me that the reason that is being done is not because of workload formulas, but instead is because of the math of dividing Wake County and keeping the district court super districts equal to the number of superior court districts and making the math work and not because of workload?
No, Representative Jackson, I wouldn't. I believe the plan that we have laid out, the different options, we are trying to not only find short-term solutions but long-term solutions for the needs of the judicial districts. I think you would agree that Wake County is growing at a pretty fast pace, and there is a need for additional resources, and we'll have to go back and pull the bill, the draft of four option B and C. But I believe you'll find one of those new seats is added in 2 years. So trying to look at adding in those additional resources moving forward the next several years, sort of expecting that the need is going to be there and planning for that. I think it's certainly better to be proactive rather than reactive, and that's what we're trying to do with those additional resources.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chairman. Representative Chairman Burr, are the two Durham Superior Court judges still double bunked in plans B and C?
Yes, sir.
And
the two Superior Court judges are double bunked, but we were able to eliminate there was a district court judge, I believe, that was double bunked. And I believe we were able to eliminate one of those double bunkings there.
And I know this committee heard at one point about the backlog of capital cases and murder trials in Durham County. How many Superior Court judges are we currently adding in plans B or C across the state?
Representative Jackson, it's a little over a dozen. Let me get you this. I've got the total here for the latest number. Let me see if I can find my old, unless staff has it, find the current totals, which I do not remember. It's in the 90s.
Question, how many Superior Court judges are added in Plan C?
Yes, sir.
They're deliberating, so hopefully we'll have an exact number. want to move on to question four before while we wait on that?
I just have two comments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you're recognized.
I think it's going to be somewhere between 10 and 12 judges, and it just seems to me if we're adding Superior Court judges across the state, and you've just heard Representative Burr say that we're gaining district court judges in Wake County just based on our anticipated growth, it seems crazy to me that in Durham County, a county that's also growing with a huge backlog in their criminal serious felony cases, that we would take two experienced Superior Court judges and we would take one away. It just, the logic to me doesn't make sense. The second thing I wanted to say is just I practice in Wake County every day, and following up on Judge John's original question, I'm in front of district court and Superior Court judges in Wake County every day, and this has been pending for about a year. Not one judge has told me this is what they want. Not one. So I just, when we talk about what the judges are okay with this and things like that, I just want the committee members to know that not one judge, Republican or Democrat, and I do talk to the Republicans, they have my cell phone, they call me often about this plan, not one person has told me this is what they want. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Heiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll only do one, and I could phrase this question, but I'll just leave it as a comment to kind of finish. And it does have to do with some previous questions about the census, and I do think it's important to note that I think, as everyone knows, the census is only conducted once every 10 years. They do put out, I think, about every 2 years, some different estimates on how they expect the population in particular areas have grown, and I think by the sixth year that would be available up to counties. They can tell you how the population's grown. But the census never again releases data that would be accurate down to the census tract level until it conducts another census in 2020. So while there are population estimates there, it may tell you what the population did in 2012, 14, 16, so forth. That is not information that is accurate when you get down to the census tract level. No one has necessarily even been on the ground in any census tract that's out there. They pick certain areas and try to sample them and forecast how others have grown. It's also important to note that just because census is conducted in 2020 doesn't mean that's when we get the data. Most of the time, a General Assembly will come in for the long session and has even had to hold special sessions to redraw their districts after those occur. So it would be well into 2021, another year on that, before we would have another census data that was coming in. I just wanted to clarify those.
Thank you. Senator Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Burr, I wanted to follow back up with you based upon the comment that you made about Mecklenburg County and going to the maps for Superior Court options B and C. What thought or consideration did you give when creating these districts for incumbency?
Senator Ford, trying to work to balance out those populations and move towards the single member districts for, as an example, based on some of the feedback I believe we received from you, we develop what's here and certainly tried to the best extent possible to eliminate double bunking. But when you have a number of the judges in Mecklenburg counties which live in the same neighborhoods in the same precincts, it's very difficult to eliminate that, but you've got the proposal there and it tries to reduce that as much as possible. Certainly if you've got another draft you'd like to present that maybe does a better job of that, certainly would welcome you to provide that to me so we could look at it. But it worked to take that into account based off the information we have to develop single member Superior Court districts that reduce that as much as possible. But it is difficult to do when you have single-member districts.
Follow up.
How many questions do you have? Just because I'll recognize you for a series if you...
Just two. This is one and one other. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Burr, for that thoughtful consideration, because in options B and C, the maps do double bunk Judge Lisa Bell and Donnie Hoover, and it also double bunks Judges Carla Archie and Karen Edie Williams. And so the rub is, the heartburn is that those judges did not compete against each other to win those seats. And so any thoughtful consideration that you could give as it relates to not placing those folks in that situation would be highly appreciative. The next question.
Follow up.
Thank you. The next question has to do with the election cycle for those judges for 2018. And do you or staff have any insight or is that going to depend upon if there's a change in these maps about how these folks who are on the ballot in 2018, what can they look forward to as it relates to this upcoming election?
Senator Ford, if I understood the first part of your question asking about the election terms for the judges, that information is on here, and we work to try to make sure that as we plugged in within the bill itself to make sure that we had the appropriate number of seats up in the correct years for when judges are up. In terms of what judges should expect for the 2018 cycle and beyond, it depends on, I think, what recommendations come out of this committee and the General Assembly over the next several months.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ford.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up. You're recognized.
So for clarity purposes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burr, depending upon what the decisions are made, I'm assuming in the short session, is there a deadline that we need to act by in order to prepare or give time for those judges to prepare for whatever election that is to come for those folks who are supposed to be on a ballot? And I know there are several options about their appointment process and or about whether or not they're going to have to run for election. But are you aware or staff aware of a deadline that we need to make a decision as to what direction that we're going to go in with these judges?
Mr. Chair, if you want to let central staff answer that, they can probably provide you what.
Senator Ford, I think what you may be trying to ask is when do the ballots need to be set for the general election in November? And I believe September 9th. It is the date that the mail-in absentee ballots have to be ready to be distributed. So by September 9th, and I apologize, I'll go back and double-check that date, but I believe that is the date the ballots have to be set with the candidates' names and printed for the November election.
Follow-up. Senator Ford. Okay. Senator Barrett, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Burr, a couple of housekeeping questions, and my wife will tell you I can't read a map, so it may be my problem there. But
You walked all over North Carolina, so
well,
you got there.
I didn't have a map, though. So I'm looking at Forsyth County.
Let me just stop you there for a minute. So staff has clarified for Senator Ford that it's September 7th, not 9th, just so you'll know. Senator Barrett.
I'm looking at Forsyth County, and I'm trying to make sense of the written materials versus the map. And maybe I can't, like I said, read a map. But so Judge Gottlieb is in 30A in my written materials, but it looks like at least here he's in 30B in the map.
Are you looking at option C is on your data?
Right. I got the map that says option C. I'm assuming that's the latest iteration.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Make sure I understand. You're looking at the dot on there, correct?
I am. It looks like it's in blue to me.
If you look at a countywide map, and there may be, or the Mr. Chair, if Eric, are the insert the maps with the inserts, are they on insets? Are they on? They are online. If you go to the committee website, and you can pull up, there's a set of maps on there that basically have zoom in on the large counties with the election districts. You can see a better, more detailed map of Forsyth County, and you'll see that he's in A there. It's the way it looks. It's the precinct right there.
Right, and 30C. Hopefully, the computer map would show this too. But 30C is vacant on this handout, but then looks like one of the judges is in 30C, if at least on the handout we have. So hopefully the computer will not indicate that.
Yeah, I think with respect to the Superior Court maps for Forsyth County, none of their.
You've got two that are double bunked. You've got, I believe you've got Judge Hall,
you're right.
Judge Burke. And that was my final question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Was there any way to, you've got four districts there, was there any way to have it so that we did not have a double bunk situation with those two judges?
Senator, we can certainly go back, take a look at that, see if it's possible to do, but happy to check into that.
Thank you.
Make a note.
Any other members wish to be recognized?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Just a question for Senator Ford, if he would. Senator Ford, on those double bunkings you identified in Mecklenburg Superior Court seats, do you have or have you received any input from anyone making a recommendation for modifications that would cure those double bunkings or either of them?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you can respond. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bishop, I am in the process of gathering that information. The first point of information that I received is about the double bunking, and as you very well know, option A is not an option because of the racial and geographical divide. So the consideration that Representative Burr has offered up, I'm appreciative of, and I look forward to taking advantage of it.
Mr. Chairman, may I follow up?
Follow up, you're recognized for a series of discussions or questions.
I think I'll just have one comment, which is, without agreeing with the premise, which Senator Ford offered at a previous meeting, and I think has been taken into account, given serious consideration in terms of option C and going with a single member plan, it does create some difficulties, but I would signal that I do think it's appropriate to make adaptations as we can to accommodate those concerns, and I invite both Senator Ford's input on it, but also input from members of our Mecklenburg community on that point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further questions about the maps, we'll move into the next item on our agenda, House Bill 240. And so, Representative Burr, how would you like to proceed? Would you want staff to explain the bill, or would you just prefer to go ahead and do it?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to run through the bill, and if you want to have staff follow up with anything I might have left out, be
all right. Go. You're recognized.
Thank you again. So, with respect to House Bill 240, that bill proposes to modify the existing general statutes on the appointment process for filling district court vacancies. The Constitution of the State of North Carolina in Article 4, Section 10 clearly gives the General Assembly the power to determine how vacancies in the office of district judge shall be filled for the remainder of an unexpired term. Under the current process permitted by the General Assembly, vacancies for district court judge are filled by the governor. Before the appointment can be made, the bar of the local judicial district where the vacancy has occurred is required to submit 5 nominees for the appointing authority to consider. But the current appointing authority is not bound by the nominations of the bar and may select someone else for the appointment. House Bill 240 proposes to change the appointment authority by giving the General Assembly the authority to make the district court vacancy appointments. The process for the local bar to weigh in on the vacancies will remain in effect under the proposed legislation. This proposal allows, I believe, for a much more transparent process for filling district court vacancies. And under the bill, these appointments will be made by the General Assembly out in the open in a public committee meeting where the public can weigh in if they so choose. And then the qualifications of the nominees will be debated and voted on by all 170 members of the General Assembly, which will include the senators and the representatives who are elected to represent the area where the vacancy has occurred and will likely be familiar with the individuals and their qualifications to serve in that position. Currently, many of these vacancies are filled in secret behind the iron fence at the governor's mansion with no involvement from the public whatsoever. And I have had a problem with that for years, and I think this bill will address the concerns that many folks have with how those vacancies are filled and will allow for a more open and transparent process here at the General Assembly where the public can actually weigh in on who's being appointed to fill a vacancy.
Representative Jackson.
For comment.
Representative Jackson.
For comment.
Yes, you're recognized.
Thank you. Well, just responding to that, I will note that the bar selection process for these judges is not done behind an iron gate. It's open to members of the bar. Most of the bars that I'm familiar with have an open forum. They invite the candidates who are interested. They require them to register and give their resumes and make their statement online, and then they have me take questions and everything. And in fact, up until we had a Republican governor elected in 2012, the selection process, the governor had to pick one of the names from the bar. But this body saw fit to change that so that the governor could choose from somebody else that the bar didn't select. And so if there's a problem with the governor selecting and going outside the list, it's a problem that we created. My problem with this is, though, is having the General Assembly select these judges. I have a real concern about time. I know that here lately we are in a lot of special sessions and come back, but there are some counties or some districts on this map that have two judges or three judges. And if there is a vacancy in August of a odd number year, that seat will not be filled until the General Assembly is back in session for the short session 10 months later. And that's a real problem. You know, the district court is where everything happens in our courthouse. It's where you go to take care of a speeding ticket. It's where you go to get a divorce. It's a judge that decides who's going to have custody of your children, your most prized thing in this world. And I think that we owe it to the people of the state to give due consideration to what it's going to be like having 200 and some district court judges and us doing the vacancy of appointments and what it's going to be like in those time periods when we're not in session because we are not a full-time legislature, at least not yet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Reeves.
Representative Burr, you'd like to respond. To respond to that, Representative Jackson, if you will read the bill, you will see that there is a process in place for appointments during the interim. And there won't be a vacancy left if there is a need to fill that. It can be filled during the interim, and there is a process in place to do that in the legislation. If you'll take a look at it, you'll see that in there.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond.
You may.
Well, unfortunately, judgeships are a little different than just filling a part-time position. Nobody's going to give up their law practice and go to the trouble to take all their clients and get them farmed out to other people and other firms and comply with all the ethical obligations for an interim appointment. And so there'll be some areas where it'll work fine. You'll find somebody who's retired or somebody who's nearing retirement who's willing to take a judgeship for 6 or 7 months to see what happens. But there's a lot of areas in this state, people just won't give up their law practice in order to do that. And I think every lawyer in this committee would agree with me on that.
Representative Burr, you want to respond or move on to Representative Reeves?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to be allowed for comment. I got to agree with Representative Jackson. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that we talk about transparency of the process. And if I'm reading this correctly, we're kind of back to the same thing during the interim as far as who's making the decision. You get a couple of people in the room, make a decision, send that, and that's it. So I don't really see how that is a different process. But I would like to talk more about transparency and accountability. I've only been here a limited time. I'll be the first to say that, and I don't have the experience a lot have. What I don't get a lot of when I'm out back home is the belief that this General Assembly works with a lot of transparency. And if that is in fact the perception, I don't see how this process suddenly makes that better. I have a huge concern about the General Assembly making judicial appointments in this manner, because again, I feel like it's infringing even further on the judicial branch of government, which is a completely separate branch of government. When I get even beyond that, the gubernatorial appointment for me does provide the accountability that I'd like, because you've got a statewide official that is making appointments, that is making decisions, as opposed to people who are elected in districts. And if the bar is not happy with an appointment made by the General Assembly, I can't quite see who the members of that county or the members of that bar or anybody else has to really talk to or to answer to, because this is going to be completely out of the hands of their particular representatives or senators. Their representatives or senators can make a comment. They can do it light, but unless they happen to have a representative who is Speaker of the House or they happen to have a senator who is the President pro tem, I don't know that they really get the input that we're presenting on this process. Whereas with a gubernatorial appointment, the governor, by default and by the nature of the position, has to reach out into all of these communities, has to be involved in these communities, has to have all types of interaction, feedback, generally has a much better chance of knowing these people than the rest of us do. If you've got 170 members here, I would be interested to know how many would really know something about a judge being appointed in Watauga County. You're not going to know the people. You're not going to know the attorneys. You're not going to know the judicial practice or anything of that sort. And so, again, I don't know that this really, if we want to make the decision because we think the General Assembly makes better decisions, then say we think the General Assembly makes better decisions. But if we want to say it's about transparency and accountability, I just have a real struggle with believing that this suddenly makes it a more transparent process. The bar meeting that Representative Jackson is talking about is an open process. You have attorneys throughout the entire district that have a chance to come together. You have a period where these people who are seeking these judgeships have a chance to talk to people, and it's basically like an election. And so when you come in, that's what happens. And when these recommendations are made, I think these recommendations are being made through a really good vetting process locally. I agree with Representative Jackson that I would like to see us go back to where the governor makes the appointment and is bound by the appointment. I think if you really want accountability and transparency, that's the way to do it. And so I would support a version of this bill that returns back to that language. But as far as the General Assembly making it, I just have a hard time believing that we're going to make better decisions in these situations, potentially, than even the local bars. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reeves. Representative Burr, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, sir. Representative Reeves, I believe you're an attorney, correct?
Unless you guys come up with something to take my bar license, yes, sir.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not surprising that you would prefer that a group of attorneys be able to pick the judge rather than have more input from the public. And I get, you know, you think that your concern is whether or not the bar is happy with a judicial candidate. I'm more concerned about whether the public's happy and the voters. The voters elected every member in here. The voters didn't elect the bar. Now, certainly they can make a recommendation, but the people in this room are the elected representatives of the voters of North Carolina. And at the end of the day, we're held accountable, not the bar. And you say those meetings are public. I don't know, and maybe I've missed it, as we've had some vacancies. I've never seen them notify the public of one of their meetings. Do they tell the public when the bar is meeting to pick who the next judge is that they're going to be standing in front of? I'm not aware of it. And furthermore, do they limit the attorneys in a particular bar? You know, you can be a member of a bar that's not in the district that you live in. So are you getting to come over to my district and pick my judge? And is that right? You know, I think those are all valid questions that I've raised in the past, and that I think at the end of the day, it's about what the public, what's best for the public. And certainly having the General Assembly, the elected representatives of the people of this state involved in that process is a much better option and is the right decision. And now you say that by changing this and moving the vacancy appointment process over to the General Assembly, that it's one branch of government interfering with another. Well, if that's the case, then is the governor interfering by filling the vacancies that he fills with the judicial branch? Are you suggesting that we should remove the constitutional authority that he has for some of the vacancies, for filling some of the vacancies in the judicial branch? Because that authority, some of it is in the Constitution, some of it is a statutory authority, and that's what I propose to change, and certainly make sure that there is more input by the people that actually know. And if you think that it's unlikely that somebody of the 170 members of the House and Senate, that it's unlikely that someone here would know these particular candidates for judge, I mean, that's absurd to say it when you're sitting here saying, well, the governor knows best. It's one person out of 10 million versus the 170 elected from across the state. Certainly there's a much better chance that the folks here at this in this place are going to know those applicants and the folks that are willing to fill one of those vacancies more so than somebody sitting over in the governor's office who is making a decision behind a closed door where the public can't have any input.
Mr. Chairman.
One, let me first address one of Representative Jackson's previous requests for a fiscal note. And so staff tells me that there's no bill that's been introduced with these particular proposals and that therefore.
William Childs, Fiscal Research. I am sorry, Representative Jackson, without an introduced bill, there cannot be an official fiscal note, just a matter of process. I can check with you when we break and talk to you about the fiscal implications.
You have a further comment, Representative Burr?
Representative Jackson, I'm happy to get you the total numbers for each of the plans of the additional Superior Court, District Court judges, and the ADAs, and I think if we can get you the increase for one of each, then you can multiply that by whatever it is and help come up with a total that you're looking for. If that's what you're interested in, is knowing the dollar amount for each of the proposals, we can help get you the information that'll give you that data.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jackson.
So that would certainly be helpful, and my guess is that is the lion's share of the cost. But the point of the request back in January was to dig a little deeper and really talk about these travel costs and these, you know, having having a Durham County Superior Court judge have to go to Dare County, North Carolina, to hold court for 6 months and to see what costs they might incur is that as well. But, you know, I'll take whatever we can get.
So the queue is getting rather large, but Representative Reeves, did you want to address directly?
Yes.
Okay, so let me go with you first, and then I've got Bishop, Barrett, Rogers, Richardson. So.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is this, is unfortunately, but I got to remember that everybody doesn't have the exact same bars in different areas. Representative Lewis and I share the same bar with Lee Harnett Bar, and I can tell you that there's no secrecy. You couldn't keep a secret in that bar if you paid everybody in there. What happens is we have public meetings at local restaurants where everybody has input and everybody has a chance to talk. And what I would equate it to, just for clarity's purposes, is the same as this. The only person that can be a committee chairperson here would be a senator or a representative. Those committee chairperson decisions are made within this body. The only person who can be a judge is an attorney. So that's why you would want to talk to the local bars, because they are other attorneys. This isn't about making your attorneys happy or anything. So they're the only ones who can be on the bench. And again, that's until the law gets changed. But right now, as the law stands, that's it. As to knowing people, I'd really be surprised if I could name, out of the 15 judges I practice in front of down in the Lee Harnett Johnson area, I'd really be surprised if a majority of members could refer to those bars. But I think I could go to the governor's office and immediately get recognition, and haven't had interaction with several members of that bench. And the bar that we have in Lee Harnett is actually a generally Republican bar. And so with that, I mean, bench. So with that being said, that is why I would prefer that. I understand that we have different opinions on that, but I do want to be clear about the process, that I am all for public process, all for transparency, all for people having an opportunity for input. But I also know that in my experience, practicing 23 years, and again, I can only speak for my area, but I've not heard one person say that they have been concerned about closed door appointments or anything of that sort when it comes down to these bench appointments. And I am concerned that people will say that if we become heavily involved in this process.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I thank Representative Reeves for his comments and Representative Jackson for his. And it all sort of brought bigger picture to mind for me. I do think, if I could offer this momentary comment on one interchange you just had about lawyers picking the judges, and I'm a lawyer, and this is a point on which I have a very strong disagreement with a man who was my mentor in the practice of law, John Wester, Buddy Wester in Charlotte, who's a terrific, outstanding lawyer and has been very active in the idea of judicial selection. And I have this firm disagreement with John Wester about this idea, and it's kind of rippled through a lot of the discussions we've had, first in the Senate committee and then here, which is, I am positive, if I ever had a chance to ask poll people in North Carolina or ask citizens, they would not want a system where lawyers, in practical effect, pick the judges. I don't disagree, Representative Reeves, that lawyers' input into the process is extraordinarily important, because the practice, it involves the practice of law. But I think we've got to be very mindful about where you stop short of lawyers tacitly picking the judges. And that then brings up another thing about what is happening tacitly. Since last November, when we began with the Senate process and all along, we've heard from presenters and received information about a lot of ideas. It's received, frankly, the process has received a lot of criticism, which is fine, but about multiple methods and approaches to selecting judges. And we've talked about election versus selection. I think I sense that the discussion of elections, we've focused a lot on districting there and trying to improve a system. I'd like to bring more uniformity to it, more of a plan to it rather than the hodgepodge that's kind of emerged over 50, 60 years. On the selection side, we've heard about, you know, the Missouri plan and the federal model and the Virginia, South Carolina model and some sort of hybrid model. Senator Newton has worked on that a good bit and presented, I think, ideas that are really valid and worthwhile. One idea that we have not had anybody come forward and say, this is what you should do, this is what we do somewhere else, this is what I'm advocating for, is to have one person pick every judge. And what's interesting is that we don't have that system in literally in North Carolina, but as a practical matter, that's about what we have. I don't think, with all due respect to Representative Rees and Jackson, that the way to fix the governor's sole appointment power and vacancies is to have the bar have more power. I don't think that's the answer. But I certainly think that is a fundamental defect. And with respect to Representative Reeves' good, cogent comment about, well, it's a statewide official, that doesn't do it for me. I think back to Governor Perdue's, creating some sort of an internal input giving mechanism and then disposing of it at the last minute and picking a bunch of people. I think having, even if it were true that the legislature's participation would reflect in the interim or whatever, just the pro tem and the speaker have an input along with the governor, that would be superior to one person in tacitly picking the entire bench. I mean, that's the way it works, is the governor appoints somebody, and then they, with the advantages of incumbency, they run an election. It is an election that, as we've all talked about, one of the defects of it is it doesn't receive a great deal of attention in the scheme of things. I think it's maybe better than the alternatives, but it's not something. So appointment is enormously important. And I think, you know, whatever the merits of House Bill 240, it is an interesting thing. It is about appointing district court vacancies. We'll hear about 241 on the special judges, but I would submit that they draw the committee's focus to this other topic, which is a sleeper from my point of view and really hasn't been addressed, and I think it ought to be addressed. Should we consider, should we broaden that? Should we offer to the people of North Carolina the opportunity to involve more than one person in picking the bench? Because that's effectively what we have now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll stop there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question, but I would just say that any time we can improve the process for selection of judges, we should look at it. And this looks like a potential opportunity to improve that process. But my question, before I make a general comment, Is there some information on the history of how we got to where we are that could be provided to this committee? I'd like to understand, you know, when we were at the point where the governor made the appointment, when we went, and obviously I wasn't here when it was changed here recently, so I'm not really aware of that and the reasons for that. But I'd like to have sort of a chronology like we had when we're studying the appointment process, so that we can sort of see the historical background. Could we get that, please?
So, staff, I think what Senator Barrett's asking for is the statute that outlined the previous process for district court selection and then the session law that changed it, whenever that was.
Right. And for 241 as well, I guess, while I'm asking. But in general, I would agree with Representative Reeves, I believe. I think the local bar needs to have a real involvement in this process if they're going to be in a statute. I think they need to be part of it. Like I said, I wasn't here when we took them out of it in terms of making a recommendation that was binding on the governor, so I can't speak to that. But I do think the bar needs to have an active role. But think about it here. If we could actually improve the vetting process for judges, wouldn't that be a good thing? So if the bar played a role in the vetting at the initial level, and then the legislature played a role with the vetting. And this is where maybe I take a different perspective, because I know the judges in Davie County, for instance. So if I'm in the Senate and somebody comes through the bar process and it comes to the legislature, I could speak to my knowledge of that judge, both from my practice and from my being in the community, because I probably know that judge. I think that's better than somebody who is over an entire state and has to base this on some recommendation from somebody somewhere on some basis that we don't really understand in terms of a qualification. It's very hard to keep up with 100 different counties. A senator can keep up with one or two counties, or maybe three, and it's a lot easier. Or a representative can keep up with one county. So I think you're really potentially improving the process. So you have the vetting at the local bar, you have the vetting by the local representative or representatives, and I think the leadership would take that into account. I don't think they're going to dismiss the statement of a representative in that area, because we have the best knowledge of the qualifications of that judge. So this has potential for me. It's intriguing as a way to improve the process. So I think we should look at this further. We should study it. We should get the history, and I'd be open to doing that.
Thank you, Senator Barrett. Representative Rogers, then Richardson, Heiss, Representative John, and Senator Newton.
Just back to Representative Reeves' comments. One of the problems with that most of us here aren't considering is the smaller districts. In the smaller districts, if you have one large firm, in my district in particular, two counties, there's one firm that's substantially larger than any other firm in the entire two counties. That firm by themselves could monopolize and pick every judge if it was bound to the lawyers picking. And that just would not work if one firm got to pick the judges, especially if the governor was bound by that. And I, for one, if the General Assembly is choosing the judges, if Representative Reeves, Representative Richardson, or Jackson, if they recommend a judge to me that's a Democrat, I'll say it in front of everybody. Some of the best judges I've ever had were Democrat judges. I would respect their opinions in their local areas. I really would. And I tend to support their decisions in those local areas as much as we could. And as far as trusting the decision of the governor, Reeves might be able to go in and get recognition by the governor, but I don't believe he hasn't invited me to breakfast yet, and I don't expect he would to pick a judge. So, but I would respect his opinion, and I truly mean that. So,
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm having a difficult time with all of this. I mean, what are we doing here? Are we doing merit selection? Are we doing looking at the districts and all the areas? Are we doing selection process? I mean, this is insane. I mean, how in the world can this committee, meeting as infrequently as it does, look at the entire, essentially what we're doing is looking at the entire process of how we handle district and superior court. It is a complicated process. This needs to be done through the courts commission, empowered to do it the right way, looking at everything that we're trying to look at in a very limited time with people that know the system far better than most of us know it. This is going to end in a disaster if we're not careful. I've got real issues with a situation where when you have a vacancy that needs to be filled while we're out of session, you say that there's a mechanism in place. As I read that mechanism, it is the Speaker and the President pro tem that make that selection. Now, how is that any better than the governor? And what I want you all to understand is the lawyers just don't sit there and pick these processes. What happens is the bar, through notice, puts out saying there needs to be a vacancy, there's a vacancy, there needs to be a selection. People offer themselves up, and they go before the bar. And the bar picks or selects three or four names out of that group. They submit those three or four names to the governor. The governor then vets those three or four. If the legislature wants to have a process in this, the constitutional way to do that is through advice and consent, not through taking over what is an executive function. Process matters. And what we're doing here is not giving justice to justice. We've got to be a lot more careful with this than we're being. And I'll say something that Representative Rogers said. the best judges I've ever sat in front of and practiced in front of, I couldn't tell you whether they were Democrat or Republican.
Representative Burr, you want to address that or just move on to the next? Senator Heiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In coming at this issue, I think important in discussing with attorneys and talking about a history of what's happened, I can at least say in Western North Carolina and others, it is very difficult for attorneys or good attorneys to decide that they want to run for a judicial race. It means that you're going to, especially against an incumbent, you're going to have at least a year period after the announcement where you're practicing in front of the person you are running against. And most lawyers would tell me that would have a tremendous impact on the justice that their clients would receive. That process has been utilized to maintain certain party holds on judicial races. Previous governors have specifically asked members to resign once they've reached full retirement so that a governor could put a new person on that bench and people would be less likely to run for that seat and make it more likely to maintain that seat years into the future for a political party. It's happened. It's happened frequently when you look. It's a consideration of whether someone who's going to turn 72 on the bench should run for another term. And a matter of fact, when we addressed last session, I think it specifically looked at flipping the balance of power of the Court of Appeals without an election because of this process. And so I think there's merit here more than just for district courts that we need to look at very deeply. I take issue with the fact that this is called an executive function. The functions of are delineated by the North Carolina Constitution, and the North Carolina Constitution says these vacancies will be filled in a matter determined by law. Now, who writes law? There's only one function that falls to. The executive branch hasn't completely taken that one, or the judicial yet. So I think that this is clearly, this is a legislative decision. The writers of our Constitution basically said, regardless of whatever court commissioner, whatever else may be out there, the writers of our Constitution said that the legislature will decide this manner and in a manner they prescribe by law. It's huge. I think we can do more to open our judicial process by making it come through the General Assembly and giving the public a real opportunity through their representatives to make it happen and get out of this. Governors, and probably of both parties, go through, and they're involved in the election of judges, now they're involved in the appointment of judges, and now we see they're using that process now, we would say, to determine the interpretation of law for their process. So I think it's very important that we make sure that this is a process that allows for an open judiciary, and any argument of separation of powers, I would also say, negated by if the legislature couldn't be it, then the executive couldn't be it either, because that would not be a separation of powers. So I think those are clear, and I think it's a good step. It's us, and I do believe I wanted to make sure for purposes this bill has already passed the House, so
right.
We're talking about whether it be brought up in the Senate. It doesn't need to be introduced right. In any other manner. So thank you.
Representative John, then Senator Newton, and Senator McKissick. And then Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just general comment and a couple of questions of Representative Burr, if I might. In regard to Senator Barrett's question about the current process, I think you'll find that it's been changed or amended 9 different times since 1965, and at no time, on none of those occasions, was a change in the appointing power considered or at least provided by law. So under both Democrat and Republican governors since 1965, the General Assembly has considered appointment by the governor to be appropriate. Representative Burr, if I might ask you, you're aware that Chief Justice Martin recently, well, within the last couple of years, established his commission on the administration of law and justice.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that was a commission made up of not only judges and, yes, lawyers, but of professors and, more importantly for this discussion, members of the private citizen community and who had some expertise in general areas of the law. You agree with that?
Public, yeah, I've not read the report in full detail, but...
Okay. Well, if you've not read the report, then you may not be able to answer this question, but the question is there anywhere in that report which recommends a change or this change in the process of appointment in the occasion of district court vacancies?
No, sir, there's not. But the great thing is, in North Carolina, the legislature is not bound by commissions, committees, boards, and reports to propose ideas and legislation and bring them up for debate and vote. We are elected by the people who sent us up here to make these decisions, and that's what we're doing now.
And what stakeholder or stakeholder groups or person or people, Representative Burr, have requested a change in this process of appointment during judicial vacancies at the district court level?
I've heard from a lot of public citizens who have requested that changes be made here and don't feel that it, over the years, have expressed concern about one group of people having absolute authority over picking the judges, and particularly, as Representative Rogers pointed out, for those of us in rural North Carolina, when you have smaller judicial districts and you have a limited number of attorneys there voting on this, that they are picking, basically have absolute control over picking who the judges are, and that this is a much better process than just going forward with letting a small group of attorneys pick the person that they're going to be standing in front of to hear their cases.
Could you be more specific than a lot, Representative Burr?
Representative John, I think the gentleman has answered your question. Do you have an additional question to propose, or perhaps an actual question to Representative Burr?
I believe I've proposed questions, Representative.
The gentleman will state his inquiry.
With all due respect,
the gentleman will state his inquiry.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not have any further questions.
Senator Newton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I want to commend Representative Burr and the House for making an effort in this direction. Based on our prior committee meetings, I think that there are some improvements we ought to talk about. This is a subject that is appropriate to talk about and consider very, very carefully. And as has been suggested earlier, it's a sort of a grave decision that we need to make here because we have the same goal in mind, all of us, I think, in this room, is to have the very best judiciary for the citizens of North Carolina that there can possibly be, through qualifications and otherwise. And the balance we've talked about and the balance that is important here to continue to keep in mind is the balance between independence of the judiciary and accountability. And our judiciary has to be independent. But obviously we don't want to be so extreme in that regard it becomes tyrannical, right? So there's got to be some accountability. What this bill does in part and what the balanced plan that we've talked about in prior meetings does is take the accountability issue and instead of finding ways to make our judges directly more accountable, it puts more accountability in the selection process. So we are going to try to do a good job on the front end to select judges who are qualified to serve the citizens of North Carolina. And in that way, because they're more qualified, they're by definition more accountable. Now, this bill then, the reason then, I think, to take it from the governor, among maybe others, to the General Assembly is the accountability. We're shifting the accountability to the nominating body. So we are in this room, we've talked about some good issues here. Another one is we're elected twice as often as the governor. We are more accountable to the people of North Carolina in that regard in terms of frequency of election than the governor. And so we're not talking about – nobody's talking about doing away with elections of judges. We're not talking about that. We're not suggesting that here. But we are talking about increasing the accountability for quality of judges because the body making the nomination is elected twice as often. So I think that has merit. I think it's an excellent idea to raise this. I think it's important that we do keep independence of our judiciary top of mind, but we have to have a process that ensures high-quality judges. And I do think that the Bar Association has a important role on the front end, but you know, my suggestion earlier to this committee, and it continues to be my suggestion, is that you know we do try to create that bipartisan committee that says these judges are all qualified. Now, whether it's the governor or whether it's this legislature, the public knows these are qualified candidates, and we'd take it from there. So just really a comment rather than a question, but thank you.
Senator McKissick, does the senator have a question?
A comment as well, and it's simply this. We can certainly look at evaluating how we best appoint vacancies for judges in the state. The existing structure that we have is one I'm very familiar with, and I think it has served us well. At the same time, are there opportunities for tweaking it and revising it? If you look at it objectively, you'd have to say perhaps there are. The question is whether what we have before us is the way to do it. I'm not convinced that what we have before us would be the way to do it. I think if you start a fear that's obviously there for very apparent reasons is, you know, what the partisan makeup of the General Assembly is going to be when something like this comes around and vacancies are appointed. If you created a mechanism where it was indeed bipartisan in the approach and bipartisan in the way it was structured, that would begin to answer some of those questions. My mind is open. I don't think this is a bill that would ever be something I could support, but at the same time, my mind is open to restructuring the way we do business today to make certain that we do get the best persons with the greatest degree of integrity that allows for openness and inclusiveness to occur so that we have an excellent judiciary across our state.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments. One, I just wanted to let the Senate know that in the House when we had this debate, I actually ran an amendment to take the power of appointment away from the legislature and give it to the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, since he would be the person, or he or she, would be the person most familiar with the court system. I thought, you know, if we wanted to take it away from the governor but put it somewhere that it could properly be done, that would be a better option, and that amendment was soundly defeated. What strikes me, though, when I read this bill is, unlike our seats, like if a vacancy occurred in House District 39, the people who selected my replacement would have to pick a Democrat, and many of you are Republicans, and if a vacancy occurred, they'd have to pick a Republican. And we've done that also with our U.S. Senator appointments recently. We've made sure that the governor would have to appoint the same party. But you won't find that language anywhere in this bill. So there is nothing to keep the General Assembly from appointing nothing but Republican judges in every district in this state, in the most Democratic district. So if there was a Democrat that had been – if that seat had always been Democratic in Durham County – there's nothing that prevents this body from saying, no, we're only going to appoint Republicans. And I think that's the true purpose behind this bill. If it wasn't, it would be structured like every other appointment bill we do, saying that the seat would be filled by the person of the same party. And I think that's a glaring omission. And, I hope you'll think about that as you move forward.
Representative Burke.
Can I ask Representative Jackson a question? Representative
yes.
Jackson.
Senator Representative Jackson, do you yield?
I do, yes, sir.
I think you pose a great question. Do you think that, as I believe you trying to remember a previous bill, but let me pose it this way. Do you believe that if we ran legislation based on the appointment authority the governor has in the Constitution to fill the other judicial vacancies, that if we put a restriction on having to pick someone of the same political party, that he should be bound by that in terms of the Superior Court judges, the district attorneys, and other vacancies that he has the power to fill, that since you're advocating that the legislature be bound by that, do you believe the governor should be bound by that same requirement for the vacancies that he fills for the judicial branch?
Representative Burr, what's in our Constitution is separate from what we're talking about. What we're talking about is doing something by law. And your argument is that the General Assembly is in the best position to make these appointments of these judges. And that the lawyers aren't, because they aren't accountable to the people. And so my point is simply, if the people saw fit in the last election to elect a Democratic judge, then at least the General Assembly, if they're going to pick the next judge, should be bound by that same, set by that same criteria.
Follow-up?
Do you yield?
I do, yes,
he
sir.
He yields.
So do you think the governor should follow that same standard for the vacancies that he fills?
I think the governor should follow the Constitution on the constitutional authority that's given him. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks.
Reluctantly, we'll recognize Representative Bluss from Guilford County.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up one more time?
Follow up. Let me go back to you.
Just to that comment, I'd also like to make clear that up until this next election, judges have been nonpartisan. And so there's been no conflict in any of those appointments, nor would they be in this bill if we had allowed judges to remain nonpartisan.
Representative Bluss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is an important area, and I would state I sure don't know the answer for how to pick the best judges. I wonder sometimes about elections because every election I'll get many calls from people that have looked at the ballot and said, who should I vote for these judges? And I don't know that the voters necessarily know when they go in and make a vote on these. And I think the drop-off in the judicial elections on the ballot is pretty telling. But I don't think I'm ready to necessarily take that away from the public either. But filling the vacancies, and when this bill was before the House, I was a no vote. And, again, mainly because of personal experience. I know, and I'm a lawyer, I don't practice much in the state courts. But when we had a Republican governor, every time there seemed to be a vacancy, I'd start getting calls from people asking me to contact the governor's office and support him. And most of the time, I wouldn't know hide nor hair about these people. District court, I don't think it matters the party that much because I don't think they do things that are very political in nature. The type cases they see, that wouldn't be quite so true with Superior. But I guess I was just loath to get the General Assembly involved in another area that I'm not sure we know that much about. And just frankly, and I guess I can say this more boldly now since I'm leaving after this term, the fact of the matter is a few people, the one thing about the General Assembly, either party, a few people hold most of the cards, and they can make the decision. Even if you think they're not making the decision, they can bring so much power to sway that I'm worried we're going to be putting in the hand of a few some of these decisions. Now, you can say that's the governor. The governor's one person, but he's elected statewide. None of us in the legislature's elected statewide. The final thing, and I'll make this a question, get your comments on it, that come to my mind is how many times have I been, and I'm already hearing it for the short session, how many times have I heard, we got to get in, we got to get out of here, and we'll have debates on the rules, and every year we've got to have a debate on the 10-bill limit, and it's all the argument is the General Assembly's temporary, we don't have the time, we can't get into all this stuff, there's not that many good ideas. So I'm wondering why in a General Assembly that's not really, I don't want to say maybe competent, but I'll use that word for now, competent to make this kind of decision on appointing judges, a General Assembly that already has apparently so much to do, we don't want to take much time even on the budget. That's got to be run through real quick. Why do we want to take on one more thing that may not be an area we have expertise when we claim we have limited time and we can't get to so many important subjects because of that limited time?
Well, Representative Blust, I think if you look at the last 17, 18 months since this General Assembly took office, you'll find that even though you insinuate we haven't been here very much, that in fact feels like we've been here quite a bit. And I think we've been in session with rare exception just about at least every other month and have been here and could fill these vacancies when we are in session. And certainly if we weren't, they could be filled by the President Pro Tem and the Speaker. But we're here, and I believe certainly the best option to fill a vacancy compared to someone doing it behind closed doors in the governor's mansion where the public has no opportunity to have any input whatsoever, and here they can have that input.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
And I'm not arguing that changes shouldn't be made, that we can improve the process, but I guess my question was more, doesn't the General Assembly already have enough to do that's things the General Assembly really is the body that has to do them and should do them?
Well, the Constitution says that it's at the discretion of the General Assembly to determine how these vacancies are filled through law. So this is up to us to decide how we're going to do it, and certainly the House has passed these bills and believes this is appropriate action for us to take. We'll now leave it in the Senate's hands to make that decision.
So let's, I think all the arguments that have been discussed on House Bill 240 are probably applicable to 241. So, Representative Burr, if you just want to briefly describe what the contents of that bill are, and then can I come back to you, Senator Van Dyne? Okay, sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair, you're correct. If you're looking at House Bill 241, mm-hmm. It's fairly similar to House Bill 240, and it modifies the process for the appointment of the special Superior Court judges. Article 4, Section 9 of the Constitution clearly gives the General Assembly the power to determine the process for the selection or appointment of special Superior Court judges, and under the current process permitted by the General Assembly, special Superior Court judges are appointed by the governor as those seats become vacant or as the term expires. And since 2013, the governor has been required to submit his nominations for special Superior Court judges to the General Assembly for confirmation. And this bill proposes to change that appointment authority and move it to the General Assembly, where the appointments will be made through the enactment of an appointments bill. And again, I think it allows for a more transparent process of making the decisions here at the General Assembly versus behind the iron fence at the governor's mansion.
I think we have in the queue Senator Barrett and then Senator Van Dyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Burr. So I was struck by the fact that, and this is probably history too, but there's a sort of filter system or filter process for district court judges going through the local bar at some level of review, but there's no
to my reading, and it's the first time I've seen it today, but no filter system for the special Superior Court judges at either the state or some other level?
There's no process prescribed by law. You're correct there, Senator Barrett. And before 2013, it was pretty much just is solely in the hands of the governor without any right. oversight whatsoever.
Well, just a comment. It strikes me that, you know, these are concepts, and if we're looking at it consistently and we're trying to improve the level review and the filters basically to make sure we have the most qualified judges possible, I'd be looking at this statute as well as the district court judge statute to have some level review by some group of qualified jurists and or attorneys to determine at least qualifications before it goes to either the governor or chief justice or legislature. The other thing I think I would point out is that going back to Representative Jackson's question, you know, I just have to say that I believe from 1868 to 1996, we did have partisan judges. And I don't have in front of me the history of that, but I'm pretty sure that the governor in power would have appointed a member of his party regardless of the party of the person departing. And I'm perfectly open to consideration of whether it's the legislature or the governor replacing that person in an interim situation with the same party and then letting the people decide after that.
Senator Van Dyne, who wins the award for farthest distance traveled to this meeting?
Thank you. And I just want to say I appreciate Senator Newton's comments about the objective being independent judges. We want independent judges. I am not an attorney. Okay, so I may oversimplify this, but when I look at what we have done in the long session with reducing the number of appellate judges and gerrymandering judicial districts, and I'm sorry, I've said this before, but I can find no justification for subdividing Buncombe County except to change the party of the judges that get elected there. And now this. This just seems just baldly political to me, and that's not independent. It's just that simple. I'd love to consider an independent panel, but the nominating body doesn't change with this. You don't get more diversity. You're still going to the Bar Association. So I appreciated the comments about small bars versus larger bars, but this doesn't fix that. I think the fact that the governor changed party affiliation in the last election is what all of this is about.
Any other members wishing to be recognized?
Just
Senator Heiss. Real you get quick. The last word.
It's a question, and I was just trying to look it up. Nominations by the General Assembly, which I assume would be passing both houses, are they subject to the veto of the governor?
No, I don't. Pose that again.
My question was, would not, as in both of these bills, and we tend to do these by bill, would a nomination of this type be subject to the veto of the governor?
Staff is looking.
Senator Heiss, I believe that it's if so long as the bill contained no other provisions in it and only appointments, that it would not be subject to the governor's veto. But perhaps right.
Yes.
It would look like that Article 2, Section, hang on just a second, 22 of our Constitution sets forth exceptions from the veto authority. And the very first exception is every bill in which the General Assembly makes an appointment or appointments to public office and which contains no other matter. So it would be up to the structure of the bill whether or not it went to the governor for veto.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for your participation today. You will be advised when the next meeting is, though I don't anticipate it will be prior to the convening of the short session. Thank you.